for listening to Bow to Fate, a podcast focusing on true crime with an emphasis on the flaws in our justice system. Today, we're going to talk about Joyce Ann Brown, who was tried and convicted in 1980 of aggravated robbery and murder. The conviction and crime all took place in Dallas, Texas, but this case is going to run us all across the United States in a story of just how wrong things can go when a prosecutor's zest for a conviction raises to all new heights. On May 6, 1980, right after 1 p.m., two African-American women walked into Fine Furs by Reuben in Dallas, Texas. One woman wore a pink jogging suit, the other a blue. Fine Furs by Reuben was owned by Reuben and Alla Donzinger. They were Holocaust survivors that had immigrated to the United States following the German invasion of their home country. That day, they were working alone in the shop. Reuben Danzinger was showing the woman in pink some furs towards the rear of the store, while Alla tended to the woman in blue up front. All hell broke loose a few moments later. The lady started yelling and shouting for both Danzingers to put all the furs in plastic bags. During the chaos, the woman in pink brandished a pistol and shoved Reuben against the rear wall. While he begged her not to hurt his wife, she shot him in the head. His body fell to the floor. She then turned the gun towards Alla. She fired one shot and missed, breaking the front window of the store. Alla hit the silent alarm so hard she broke her fingernail. The woman with the gun moved closer to Alla, while the one in blue continued to shove furs into the bags. She pointed the gun again directly at Alla Donzinger's head. Thinking quickly, Alla begged the robbers not to kill her, saying she had a terminal illness and would soon be dead anyways. At that point, the woman in pink pulled the gun back and said, "We'll just let you suffer." She then ordered Alla towards the rear of the store while they made their way out the front. Alla watched as they got into a brown Datsun with a person waiting inside and sped away. She then made her way to her husband who lay bleeding on the floor. Reuben Danzinger died that day, waiting for help to arrive in the arms of his wife. Dallas PD quickly responded to the silent alarm. They were on the scene within minutes. With the description of the assailants and the car, the hunt was on. It wasn't long before they found the brown Datsun abandoned on the side of the road a short distance from the store. In the front seat, they found a rental receipt showing the car was rented in Denver, Colorado, by Joyce Ann Brown. This is where our story begins to get confusing. Back at the department, a young vice detective remembered arresting a Joyce Ann Brown on suspicion of prostitution a few years back. They quickly pulled up the booking photo and showed it to Alla Donzinger. Alla confirmed she was one of the women who burglarized the store. However, she was not the woman that shot her husband. Other detectives were following up on the rental receipt. It was, in fact, rented by a Joyce Ann Brown who lived in Denver, Colorado. But this wasn't the same Joyce Ann Brown who was arrested for prostitution in Dallas, Texas. They confirmed that Denver Joyce had rented the car and that she was at work on the day of the robbery in Denver, Colorado, meaning that she wasn't part of the robbery plot. Denver Joyce told Dallas police that she rented the car for a friend, Renee Taylor, and she had not seen her since. A bolo was issued for Renee Taylor, and Dallas police made their way to her apartment with a search warrant in hand. In the apartment, they found the pistol used to kill Reuben Danzinger, furs from the store, and a pink jumpsuit. They still weren't able to locate Renee Taylor, though. Renee Taylor had a hefty rap sheet and was known to target furriers across the states. She was wanted on several charges of robbery, along with her suspected accomplice, Lorraine Germany, who bore a striking resemblance to Dallas Joyce Ann Brown. There were warrants out for both their arrests in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for a robbery of another fur shop that took place just 2 weeks before the Danzinger robbery. The women in the robbery were seen wearing jumpsuits, one pink and one blue. To show you how much Lorraine Germany looked like Joyce Ann Brown, I posted a side-by-side image of them both on our current events tab at bowtofate.com. Please take a look. I believe after reviewing those images, you're going to be able to understand how Alla Donzinger could misidentify Dallas Joyce Ann Brown for this crime. Right here is where Dallas police could have recognized the coincidence they had on their hand and shown Alla Danziger a photo of Lorraine Germany to see if she'd change her mind about the identification of Dallas Joyce Ann Brown. They knew Germany looked a lot like their Dallas Brown, and they also knew they had no evidence to tie Dallas Brown to Renee Taylor. Yet, they decided to proceed. In the newspaper that Sunday, an article reported that they were looking for Dallas Joyce Ann Brown in connection with a robbery and murder at a furrier shop. Brown's mother called her and told her about the article. Joyce then went down to the store to get the paper and read the information for herself. In 2012, BET's Vindicated completed two episodes about Joyce Ann Brown. Here's a clip from those episodes. Joyce and her mother remember this fateful conversation in their own words.
I got a call from one of my friends.
She said Miss Nanny just called and said that they're looking for you in connection with some robbery.
I was knocked off my feet.
Picked up the telephone and I called Miss Nanny. She said, baby girl, I'm reading in the paper that they're looking for Joyce Ann Brown, and I stopped her. A lot of things went through my mind. Maybe she needed her glasses. Maybe she just didn't know what she was talking about, but my heart kept telling me otherwise.
After reading that the detectives were looking for her, Joyce resolved to go down to the station the next morning and clear this entire thing up. Her husband, on the other hand, warned her not to walk into that station, recalling that he feared they would never let her go. On Monday morning, ignoring her husband's warning, Joyce Ann Brown marched herself into the local precinct in order to declare her innocence and straighten out this entire debacle. She was arrested that morning for the robbery and murder of Reuben Danziger. This is Joyce describing her first interaction with Dallas police.
He didn't ask me if. He wanted to know why. Did I go rob that store? And when I told him that I did not commit a crime, he looked at me and called me a liar.
A crime she did not do.
Joyce Ann is not that type of person.
So he said, book her.
Dallas police immediately applied for a search warrant for the home of Joyce Ann Brown. They drove Alla Danziger by the Browns' home. Outside, a neighbor was working on his truck. Alla Danziger identified him as the man driving the getaway vehicle. Police took the man into custody, but later found he had a solid alibi. He was picking up his wife for lunch at a dentist office where she worked. Several patients and the entire staff confirmed his presence, meaning there was no way he could have driven the getaway vehicle. The search of the Browns' home produced nothing at all linking our Dallas Joyce Ann Brown to the crime. Dallas Joyce had an alibi. She was working at the time of the robbery. However, in another unlucky coincidence for our Joyce Ann Brown, she was employed with a different furrier shop located a few miles from Fine Furs by Reuben. They just so happened to be in direct competition with each other. This led Dallas police to question whether she committed the crime due to some sort of sordid loyalty. Joyce worked all day that May 6th. Her time card showed her clocking in at 8:48 a.m. and clocking out at 4:12 p.m. She did not take a lunch that day and confirmed that she seldom did. Joyce was the office manager, and she had an extensive knowledge of the office phone systems that often went haywire. She told police that she hardly ever left the office for fear that someone would have an issue with the phones and need her. Police went about interviewing people at her work in an attempt to break down Brown's alibi. They found that every minute of Brown's day was accounted for, aside for a 22-minute time period starting at around 12:55 p.m. and running to 1:16 p.m. No one could recall seeing Brown at work during this period. Dallas police surmised that Joyce Ann Brown had snuck out of work without being seen by anyone, changed her clothes because coworkers had confirmed that Brown was wearing a white dress and a red blouse that day, not the blue jumpsuit worn by the suspect. She drove to meet her accomplices, changed cars, rode with those accomplices to Fine Furs by Reuben, committed the crime, drove back to her car, changed clothes again, and then drove back to work, again, without being seen, and got to her desk all in a short 22-minute window. Keep in mind that the woman walked through the door of Fine Furs by Reuben just a few minutes after 1 p.m. that day, meaning Joyce would have had to meet her accomplices, change clothes, get to the Donziger store, all in about 7 minutes. Not to mention, battle the Dallas lunchtime traffic. I can't even get out of the parking lot in 7 minutes during lunchtime, so I couldn't imagine trying to do all this, then be part in a murder and return to work like nothing had happened. Joyce's co-workers say there was nothing out of the ordinary with Brown's actions or behaviors following lunch that day. Dallas police proceeded with their investigation, speculating that Brown feasibly could have committed the crime, rather than believing Brown's own account that she had simply stayed at work through lunch that day. This investigation was driven by tunnel vision. From the moment that young vice detective remembered Joyce Ann Brown, the case was built around the idea that she had committed the crime, even when logic had to dictate that detectives were working on faulty information. Detectives only paid credence to the facts that would help prove their idea that Joyce Ann Brown had committed this robbery. Beginning an investigation with an already assumed conclusion is very dangerous. Anything that can help support your foregone conclusion immediately gains the limelight, where information that may lead to a more realistic accounting becomes overshadowed and obsolete. Police detectives are not the only people that do this. In reality, we all do. It's how our minds work. We form a hypothesis, then we work to prove that hypothesis. The danger arises when we ignore evidence to disprove our theories, such as in the case of Joyce Ann Brown. When detectives brought their case before Assistant District Attorney Norm Kine, it was his responsibility to review all the information and make a decision whether or not to prosecute Dallas Joyce Ann Brown for this crime. So let's take a look at what he has to work with. He has the testimony of Alla Donziger. Knowing eyewitness testimony is fickle, he understands that he needs more. Alla had already misidentified the getaway driver, so we know that there's room for error in her memory. He had the brown Datsun as well. They had fingerprints and physical evidence inside. They matched the fingerprints in the car to Renee Taylor, and they found two other sets of prints. Acumen would leave one to believe that these unidentified prints belonged to the getaway driver and the second culprit, but neither of the prints matched Dallas Joyce Ann Brown. The search of Brown's home had turned up no physical evidence of the crime. They couldn't find anything closely resembling a blue jumpsuit or any of the furs. Kine had no proof that Dallas Brown knew or had ever even met Renee Taylor. Nothing in their lives crossed, aside from the fact that they were both African-American. Renee Taylor's still on the run, and police, as of yet, have been unable to locate her. So Kine knows there's no hope of using her testimony against Dallas Joyce. Kine also had to deal with other Furrier robberies as well. Norman Kine met with detectives from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to ascertain the connection between the two crimes. He traveled to New Mexico and reviewed the crime scene as well as their evidence. New Mexico detectives had recently taken into custody Lorraine Germany. They were also on the lookout for Renee Taylor. They shared that Germany had been caught with furs from various robberies and was in possession of a blue jumpsuit. They were getting ready to prosecute her for the robbery in Albuquerque and shared with Kine the connection between Taylor and Germany. The two were known across the Midwest for committing Furrier robberies together. It was at this moment that Kine could have requested that fingerprints found in the brown Datsun be tested against Lorraine Germany, but defying all sense of reason, he does not do this. Instead, he returns home and decides to move forward with prosecuting Joyce Ann Brown for aggravated robbery and murder. Since the day Joyce Ann Brown decided to clear her name by walking into Dallas Police Precinct, she has been in their custody. She was housed at the county jail awaiting trial. Her cellmate was a woman named Martha Jean Bruce. She was awaiting sentencing for an attempted murder when Brown joined her in the cell. In a true showing of hypocrisy, she warned Brown not to say anything to anyone because they would be the first person to go down and make a statement against you to the Dallas PD. Shortly before the trial began, Martha Jean Bruce did just that. She supposedly told prosecutors that Brown had told her that she did in fact commit the robbery and explained how, a fact that Brown would not know until Martha Jean Bruce would take the stand against her. The jury selection began for Brown a few weeks before the trial. A jury of one's peers is guaranteed right of a criminal defendant, in which peer means equal. This has been interpreted by courts to mean that the available jurors include a broad spectrum of the population, particularly of race, national origin, and gender. This, however, was not the case for Joyce Ann Brown, an African-American woman from the lower rung of the social classes. Her peers that would decide her fate consisted of 11 men and one woman, all white. On September 29, 1980, at 9 a.m., court was in session for the aggravated robbery of Fine Furs by Reuben and the subsequent murder of Reuben Danziger. Norman Kine, the assistant state attorney, was a gifted orator and a fantastic storyteller. He created a web that would tie all the loose ends of this case magically together. Kine stood before a jury and created a story that was so unbelievable that it just had to be true. He put forth the theory that Dallas Brown and her husband Lee Visor were in cahoots with Denver Brown and an underworld acquaintance, Selma Fletcher. Kine surmised that they had all conspired to rent the car under Denver Brown's name, then use Dallas Brown and Renee Taylor to commit the crime to throw off detectives. He didn't have a single piece of evidence to prove this theory, but that didn't stop him from professing it over and over again in front of a jury. He cast doubt upon Joyce Ann Brown's integrity and highlighted her conviction for prostitution 2 years before. Kine made her look like a sleuthing criminal who had evaded police for years in a scandalous prostitution ring before finally being caught. Kine called to the stand Martha Jean Bruce, Brown's cellmate in the Dallas jail. Her testimony was vague and evasive, but she did manage to testify to some of the details that she said Brown had told her, and that only the robbers and the prosecutor knew. Bruce met with Kine shortly before her testimony to review the statements that she would make to the jury. Bruce testified in the stand that she was not offered anything by the prosecution for her testimony. She told the jury that, over various conversations, Brown had told her that she worked at the furrier store to learn which furs were valuable and had planned the robbery herself. She also testified Brown told her that she had driven to Denver and rented the car, which even the police knew to be incorrect, and that after the robbery, furs were put into plastic bags and transferred by truck by a man named Jerry. She went on to say that Brown had wore a blue dress and a black wig to commit the crime. Martha Bruce told jurors that if convicted, Joyce Ann Brown would tell on all the others involved. Here's a clip from one of the jurors, Dan Peeler, reflecting on the testimony of Martha Jean Bruce.
I would say the opinion in the jury room on Joyce was split pretty much down the middle until we finally heard this last witness. She was the person that actually said Joyce admitted she did it.
Kine was dancing around the courtroom, hiding the fact that his case had little substance with innuendo and double entendre. Kine's timetable for the crime teetered on ridiculousness. There was no conceivable way that Joyce Ann Brown would have enough time to commit this crime. This was the point at which Alla Danziger took the stand. Her testimony was hard for a jury to hear. She was an emotional wreck, and rightfully so. Her husband had just been murdered in a place that was meant to be safe. The judge asked her several times if she needed to stop, because her words could barely be distinguished from her anguished sobs. At the end of her testimony, she looked right at Brown and began screaming. Why did you do it? Why did you do it? You took my purse with everything else. You ruined my life. You took my life, my husband's life, and my life. That was probably what clinched it for the prosecution. Her raw, unadulterated pain on the stand was so powerful the jury just had to believe her. Eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, and juries are left to judge the credibility of witnesses without ever having experienced doing so before. Bias creeps into our memory with our own knowledge without our awareness. Our confidence and accuracy are generally correlated. When misleading information is given, like showing a witness a picture of a person who police suspect of committing a crime, witness confidence is often higher for incorrect information than for the correct information. This leads many experts to question the competence of the average person serving on a jury to determine the credibility issues in regards to eyewitnesses. A lot of people believe that human memory works like a video recorder. The mind records events and then, on cue, plays them back at an exact replica. On the contrary, psychologists have found that memories are reconstructed rather than played back each time we recall them. The act of remembering is more like putting together a puzzle rather than pushing play on a recording. Even questioning by a lawyer or a detective can alter the witness's testimony because fragments of the memory may unknowingly be combined with information provided by the questioner, leading to an inaccurate recall of the events. Scientific America lists a number of factors that can reduce the accuracy of eyewitness identifications. Here are just a few of them. Extreme witness stress at the crime scene or during the identification process. The presence of a weapon at the crime, because this can intensify the stress and distract witnesses. Witnesses, of course, pay more attention to the weapon than the perpetrators. Using a disguise by a perpetrator, such as a mask, a wig, or in this case, a scarf. A racial disparity between the witness and the suspect. There are studies that prove that identifications across race lines are especially difficult. A brief viewing time to the lineup or other identification procedures. Keep in mind, Dallas police showed Alla Danziger a picture of Dallas Joyce Ann Brown prior to her making the identification. All of these factors were present when Alla Danziger identified Dallas Joyce Ann Brown. We don't get to blame Alla Danziger for misidentification that day. She was a victim. Investigators are responsible for identifying these instances and properly investigating the crime without bias. The defense laid out their case in a less theatric method, choosing reason and logic and pleading with the jury to listen and see the facts or lack thereof in this case. They called many of Brown's co-workers to the stand who testified not only of her actions and whereabouts on the day of the crime, but of her stellar character as well. Joyce Ann Brown had turned her life around after being prosecuted for prostitution, a path she'd only taken to support her two young children. The defense showed the jury how ridiculous it was to say that Brown was able to leave work, change clothes, change cars, commit the crime, change clothes, change cars, and return to work acting like nothing happened in only 22 minutes. It mattered very little, however. The trial barely lasted a week. In October of 1980, the case was remanded to the jury. They deliberated just a few short hours, asking for the testimony of Alla Danziger to be read to them again. They returned to the courtroom that same day with a verdict. The judge read their decision to the court. Joyce Ann Brown relayed her recollection of this moment in BET's television show Vindicated.
An all-white jury says, after 8 days, that we find the defendant guilty of aggravated robbery and murder, and punishment was assessed at life in prison.
They found Joyce Ann Brown guilty of aggravated robbery and murder. The judge sentenced her to life in prison. Brown was in shock, and frankly, so were her attorneys. They were sure that the testimony of Martha Bruce, the jailhouse snitch, swayed the jury towards a guilty verdict, and they immediately started working towards an appeal. On March 23, 1981, police arrested Renee Taylor for shoplifting in Troy, Michigan. She was extradited to Texas to stand trial for the murder of Reuben Danziger. Taylor worked out a plea deal to avoid the death penalty. She pleaded guilty in exchange for life in prison. She refused to name her accomplice, only saying that it was not Joyce Ann Brown. Brown's attorneys working an appeal found that Martha Jean Bruce had lied on the stand regarding previous convictions and also found that she'd been convicted of giving a false statement to police officers just 6 months before the trial. They also guessed that Martha Jean Bruce was given a deal in exchange for her testimony, and went about trying to prove it. Bruce was sentenced to 5 years in prison for attempted murder at the time she testified for Joyce Ann Brown. Just 6 months after the trial, she walked out of jail a free woman. Brown's attorney found that Henry Wade, Norm Kine's co-worker, had written a letter to the Texas Board of Pardons and Parolees requesting that Bruce's sentence be reduced and commuted because of evidence not known at trial. Wade, who prosecuted Bruce for attempted murder, now said that she was a victim of domestic violence and only reacted in fear for her own life. The board agreed with Wade and commuted Bruce's sentence in a sweetheart deal that is usually reserved for politicians and their relatives. Despite the proof and clear Brady violations made by Norm and Kine by not disclosing integral parts of Bruce's past, in December of 1984, the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals rejected Brown's appeal, stating they did not believe knowledge of Martha Jean Bruce's past or potential deal with prosecutors would have changed the minds of the jury. Here is Brown's reaction after reading the appeals decision.
What's sticking in my mind is that the appeals court sent an opinion, and when I read it, it said that it brought the questions of my innocence. But literally, they were not interested in innocent or guilt, just simply if they took me to court fairly. How do you take an innocent person to court fairly?
Despite all hope being lost, Joyce Ann Brown did not give up. After her appeal was denied, Brown began writing to different organizations and individuals connected with wrongful convictions. One of those people put her in contact with James McCloskey and Centurion Ministries. McCloskey got his hands on Brown's trial transcripts and appeal documents and was easily persuaded that she was innocent. McCloskey hired an investigator to follow up leads that the Dallas PD had ignored because they didn't fit their account of the crime. They spoke with Renee Taylor, who still refused to name her accomplice, but she did say that the woman that helped her in the Donziger robbery was the same woman that pulled the job with her in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Investigators headed to New Mexico. They talked with detectives there who pointed them towards Lorraine, Germany. Lorraine had been tried for robbery in New Mexico. However, she was acquitted after her father, a retired police officer, testified that she was with him at the time of the crime. New Mexico detectives told McCloskey and his investigators, despite the father's testimony, they knew they had their hands on the right woman. Investigators then headed to Denver, Colorado, where they found Lorraine Germany, who was serving an extensive sentence for a slew of robberies in the area. After realizing that she could not be charged for the New Mexico robbery again due to double jeopardy, she freely told McCloskey that she had committed the New Mexico robbery with Renee Taylor. However, she would not admit to having any part in the Donziger murder. Little of this mattered, however. McCloskey released his findings to the press, and news of a wrongfully convicted woman garnered a lot of attention. Joyce Ann Brown was interviewed for 60 Minutes, and her case gained substantial notoriety. The press began to call for Prosecutor Norman Kine to test the fingerprints found in the Brown Datsun used in the Donziger murder against those of Lorraine Germany. Kine finally relented and told the press he tested the prints and they were not a match. Here's the thing, though. He lied. He never tested those prints, and in fact, he never requested corresponding prints of Lorraine Germany be sent to him, even though this phone call would have taken less than 5 minutes and caused him no trouble at all. He couldn't even be bothered to make the call. By this time, Joyce Ann Brown was a household name, and her phone was ringing off the hook from attorneys offering their services free of charge. They filed a writ of habeas corpus for Joyce Ann Brown, alleging prosecutorial misconduct by Norman Kine, who they accused of working in concert with Dallas police to suppress evidence favorable to Brown. The writ also argued that Norman Kine intentionally used testimony which he knew or should have known to be perjurious, and suppressed evidence that could have been used to impeach Martha Jean Bruce. For his part, Norman Kine acknowledged that Bruce's record should have been disclosed and did not strongly oppose a new trial. However, he insisted that Joyce Ann Brown was guilty, and he advised if overturned, he would retry this case. On November 4, 1989, after serving 9.5 years in prison for a crime she did not commit, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned her conviction and released Joyce Ann Brown from prison. The case was never retried. After publicity died down, it was quietly dismissed and forgotten. To this day, Alla Donzinger is sure that Joyce Ann Brown helped kill her husband, refusing to believe she could have identified the wrong person. Joyce Ann Brown spent more than 9 years in prison. During that time, her stepson had committed suicide, a fact that she blamed herself for. She was sure that if she could have been there, she could have changed something.
I made a promise in 1986 to my God that not if, but when I was released from that bondage, that I would spend the rest of my life fighting for those that's less fortunate.
Brown lived up to that promise. After her release, she founded MASS, Mothers and Fathers for the Advancement of Social System, which aids both wrongfully convicted prisoners and released convicts seeking to reenter society. She settled in Dallas and wrote a book about her experience called Justice Denied. Here's a clip of Joyce Ann Brown explaining why she started MASS.
I do this work not because I have to, but because I want to. Because the 9 years, 5 months, and 24 days that I spent in prison for a crime I didn't commit educated me on things that need to happen when people are released back into prison. You see, the state can't give me my son who took a .38 and blowed his brains out. State can't give me back that my daughter became a teenage pregnancy because she was rebelling, thinking nobody was listening. Nobody was trying to help her mother come home. That's the reason why I do this work, because I found out in prison how once you pay your debt to society and come home, there's nothing there for you. For the last 20 years, I've been working with formerly incarcerated people, placing them in a position to become productive citizens in society. So Brenda, young lady, came in on me during the 9 years that I was there 3 times. She says, Joyce, I didn't have any help. I'm a dope fiend. I didn't get any services for my addiction. She said, what they caught me with, they wouldn't have never caught me with. I went and committed a crime and drew attention to myself to come to prison to get 3 hots and a cot. And sitting in prison, that didn't make sense to me. A person that paid their debt to society shouldn't have to come back and get 3 hots and a cot. They should be able to get a job. They should be able to put a roof over their head and food on the table for their families out here. Yes, they committed a crime, but they paid their debt. They worked for however long they were there. I worked 9 years, 5 months, and 24 days. I wasn't sick in prison. I worked 9 years, 5 months, and 24 days. Never have been paid a day for one day that I spent in prison for a crime that I didn't commit. But I can't let that stop me, because there's 160,000 plus people in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice that one day is going to come home, and they're going to need a helping hand. So long as God put breath in my body, I will be there, and I will be their helping hand.
Brown was a staunch defender of justice and held fast to her convictions. She participated in innocent projects across the country and was extremely critical of not only her prosecutor, but the entire judicial system. She once told a reporter that she was wrongfully convicted of killing a white man by a white prosecutor, presided over by a white judge, defended by a white attorney, trying to prove her innocence to a white jury. Once convicted, she was taken by a white bus to a white jail and given white clothes. She suspected the justice system was intentionally trying to strip any color whatsoever from her life. Despite her anger, Joyce Ann Brown said this of our current justice system.
We have a long ways to go, but you can see the system changing.
After her release, Brown refused to apply for a pardon, asserting that she had done nothing, and that if anything, the state should ask for her pardon. Her stand rendered her ineligible for compensation, because a pardon is a prerequisite to payment under Texas law. She continued to campaign for compensation for her wrongful conviction that would not require her to seek a pardon. But her efforts were never successful. On June 13, 2015, Brown passed away in Dallas after suffering a heart attack. Brown's case created the first real front-page news of a wrongful conviction in Texas. It allowed defense attorneys the chance to have juries actually believe prosecutors, eyewitnesses, or even detectives could be wrong. It created the first real sense of reasonable doubt in jurors, not just in Texas, but across the country. In future episodes, we're going to continue to review some of these cases of the wrongfully convicted. So please stay tuned. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us today. We're going to continue to bring you quality episodes on a regular basis. If you haven't visited our website, you can find us at vowtofaith.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or send a tweet to @vowtofaithpod. And if you get a chance, please subscribe to our podcast to stay up to date with current events. Feel free to send us an email at vowtofaith@gmail.com with your suggestions for upcoming episodes, or call and leave a voicemail at 725-222-FATE, F-A-T-E. You may just end up on the podcast. Till next time, stay safe and keep listening. Thank you.